Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's Friday, and that means that I get to sit in a room with a bunch of people and talk about stuff that's cool.
Really mixing it up.
That was like the worst intro ever. I'm Dave Etler for the Short Coat Podcast, here with Corbin Weaver.
Hello.
Todd, Dylan Todd.
Hi.
I feel like you're just doing it on purpose now.
I feel like my brain is doing it on purpose. I'm here with Mark Terrell.
Hey.
And I'm here with John Pianta, who's fresh from the wards. We haven't seen you in
trenches.
Weeks. We haven't been the benefits of your loquacious personality for a long time.
I don't even know what to say with that. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good. I thought it was kind of a slow news week this week. But I've been disagreed with. So, John, tell us the thing that caught your eye this week. The big one.
How big?
Okay.
Mega big?
We are not alone.
Mega structures big?
Yes. We are not alone. The Kardashians are with us.
So,
that's not good.
I can't even keep a straight face on that one.
Sorry. Why are we not alone, John?
Well, to put it simply, there's been a discovery of some very strange behavior in the movement of the light of a star in deep space. And they've tried to sort of look at all of the other natural explanations for why the fluctuation would occur. And they kind of ran out of them.
Yeah.
You know, so they're looking at really ridiculous probabilities, like that some kind of asteroid belt got pulled in front of this star by another star or something, or that there is some sort of like giant megastructure built around the star, which I personally think that one's much cooler.
Yeah.
Certainly cooler.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so here's what I read about. I'd forgotten about this. I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, life has changed. No, I don't know for sure. But look, here's what. Yes, you're right. They couldn't. They, you know, sort of looked at the change in the star's brightness. They couldn't match it to any particular phenomenon that we're sort of aware of. So, and the clincher was that, you know, like, you know, when a planet passes in front of a star, it blocks a certain amount of light. But it's usually not much. I mean, you have to have really, you know, super sensitive instruments to detect it, which you probably did anyway. But the point is that the albedo of the star went down like 22%, which is completely unheard of. If Jupiter crossed in front of that same star, it would probably bring it down only by, you know, like a couple of percent. And wow. It happened at such irregular intervals that
you're saying there's something is killing the light of this star?
Something is,
yeah. Maybe there's a Death Star floating around that star.
Oh, shiz. I hope not. But anyway, that is very exciting.
Yeah, well, the researcher, she came up with all these explanations and then pitched it to a guy that's involved in looking for extraterrestrial life. And this is something that he proposed that, sure, it's possible, but I mean,
you seem
with
skeptical.
That kind of... Of course, I'm spectacle to jump immediately to giant alien megastructure responsible for the slight dimming of a star because we can't possibly accept any other alternative.
He's so.
What's your alternative, smartass?
He's so skeptical. He's a spectacle.
I don't even know what to say to that. But I mean, I don't know. There could be a variety of phenomena that are happening. Just space things that we just haven't observed yet that doesn't necessarily conclude to aliens that have built a giant structure that we can identify that is draining like star energy or something. Like
it's draining star.
I don't know star what it's doing.
It's something is blocking the light.
But yeah. If this is my thought, if Jupiter couldn't dim it this much, why could some
random alien mega structure.
Well, how do we know something is truly dimming it? How do we know something on the other side of it isn't? Like, how would a black hole look when it first starts approaching a star?
These are things they've already investigated because they actually know the answer to those questions. Hmm. Which is, this is the thing, like, and I think it brings to question, like, a lot of, you know, so people say, well, if we prove that there was life on another planet today, you know, it would change the world. I'm not really sure that it would, because honestly, so many people just don't understand it. Like, you know, this is how we're going to show that there is life somewhere else in the universe. And most people in the world are going to be like, so you're telling me that some radio waves from some star that's like 100 million years old radio waves suggests that, you know, well, like,
I think the in a skepticism
society that barely
right
understands
there,
radio waves, that's right.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, so really
says,
what you do
smugly.
is you just try to come up with all the possible explanations. Mm-hmm. And assign probabilities to them
as a possibility.
Yeah, so it's got to be, and this is how we think in medicine too,
and
right?
And
you sort of come up with all the possibilities, you put them on your list of your differential, sort of rank order them in terms of their probability, and then rule them out. And that's what they've done.
Way to bring it back to medicine.
Well, this is the short coat.
I know.
I'm short and coated.
I had no way to do that. Very good.
In what?
You don't want to know.
Yeah. At least you don't have your white coat on.
I took that off.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. I don't care what.
I mean, trust me. I hope it's an alien.
I don't care what Mark says. I don't care. All you and all your sciencey.
I just want to study xenolinguistics. Whenever, like, in Star Trek, Uhura's like, yes, I have, like, a PhD in, like, xenolinguistics. I was like, that is so cool.
You could get a PhD in xenoastrobiology, which is pretty cool. Like, you're looking at how do you detect, like, molecular biochemistry products with radio telescopes. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
that you can even do that. Be like, hey, we know actually that cloud of gas is made out of formaldehyde, which is insane because you know, that's formaldehyde floating out in space.
I'm just gonna dumb down the conversation a little bit here and say, if it is a giant alien megastructure, props to us for finding it.
Because it was actually, wasn't it amateur? I think they like crowdsourced this data, and it was like amateur planetologists that discovered it.
I always figured if we found out there was, you know, life elsewhere, it was going to be in some sort of terrible aliens and attacking the Earth, sort of we're the inferior species. So maybe preemptively we're finding something that is a good sign for us.
So when they come to invade us, we can
played Mass Effect. Maybe it's a mass relay.
Exactly.
That's what I hope for.
If we, you know, the very best thing about it is, you know, say it's like 10 million light years away. Now we know that in 10 million years, they could be coming for us.
Yeah. Well, but that's no problem, because when they come to invade us, we'll be like, hey, we saw you first.
And probably blew ourselves up.
Step off, aliens.
They'll just find a desolate planet.
You know, actually, the thing out of this that makes me the most excited, to be completely honest, when I was reading the article, I read that it was also like a crowdsourced experiment, and that 150,000 amateur planet astronomer people were involved. And I thought, there are 150,000 people interested in analyzing planetary data. There may be hope yet for this world.
Well, you know what's interesting is that
Can't find funding to do it full time.
Well, no, like,
they're amateur.
If there's 150,000 people that were like qualified to do that and wanting to do that, I think that would be a good thing for the world. Because we usually hear about like 150,000 people that want to like shut down Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
or figure out what dress, like what color that dress really is.
Right.
But people
overestimate.
Except
that's like 150 million.
People overestimate how much of the night sky we actually can look at once too. A lot of people think that with like current telescopes and scanning technology, we kind of are looking at all the stars simultaneously, but really we're looking at such a small amount that it's actually a big deal to have just extra eyes looking in different places.
True as in life.
Is it? Where would your extra eyes be looking, Dave?
Dave actually didn't say that. He has a soundboard down there that he's pushing on. It says Dave's words of wisdom.
I just have nothing to contribute anymore.
It's okay. We can move on. We beat that one to death.
We're learning a lot about Ebola, right? Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we've learned is that Ebola can stay in semen 9 months after onset, or can be, you know, anyway. It can be transmitted months after acute illness has resolved. It's less likely to happen, but it is possible.
Do you know how it's a little worrisome?
I don't think we know. I don't think we know yet. We just know it's possible.
We just know it's possible.
We know that it hides in immune privileged sites in the body, like the testicles and the eyes and the brain. What we do know is that 40% of people studied at a Liberian clinic have pain, inflammation, blurred vision, uveitis, and blind spots because of their Ebola infection. So of the people who survived, 40% at this clinic, particular clinic, have all these symptoms.
I feel like this should be less surprising, seeing how sick they are when they have it.
Well,
we know a lot about autoimmune phenomenon that are caused by illnesses, but like this could just be you are gonna die. And you, like, barely survive.
Yeah. Well, and we have this nurse, Scottish nurse, I guess she is, Pauline Caffrey, who has relapsed after being symptom-free since December. Hmm. She's critically ill in a London hospital. And I was wondering, the things that I've read haven't yet said this, although they've implied it. Is this how Ebola has this history of going away and coming back and going away and coming back, and we never quite know, you know, where the reservoir is and why it's happening. Doesn't this seem likely that this is the reservoir? You know, it just sort of hides away like herpes or whatever, and then comes out every once in a while and, you know, messes with an African country.
There are some identified reservoirs. Like, isn't bats? Bats are a thing, and like a lot of people.
I was under the impression, and this may be old information. I was under the impression that they didn't know for sure. They suspected that, but they haven't been able to really. That may be old information. I don't know,
Dave. We don't know anything for sure.
I would be skeptical of that, mostly because
of the bats thing, or of the
no. I'm not skeptical of the bats.
Okay.
I haven't done research on the bats, but it seems like
pretty well known that viruses have animal hosts. Right.
And bats are pretty common. Bats are gross. And they flying do eat rats. Grass. Yeah, so. Like, that's gross. so that makes sense. But I think if you look prior to this Ebola outbreak, you know, we've had a lot of the Ebola outbreaks actually happened like in the Congo, for instance.
Right.
You know, they kind of scattered throughout that kind of region in Africa, that very similar climate region. So I think it's unlikely that it's just, you know, hiding out in humans and causing these outbreaks. I think it has more to do with like probably, you know, bats in the reservoir somewhere where this animal likes to live because of this climate. And so,
but here's what I've been thinking about after I read a couple of articles, and so I have no idea whether it's true or not. So what we know now is that there's all these people with Ebola hiding in their eyeballs and their testicles and wherever.
Everywhere you want.
We know that they're there now, right? And this past outbreak was huge in comparison to other outbreaks. So now we have this known reservoir after a huge outbreak, relatively huge outbreak. And so if that reservoir didn't exist in the past, it's definitely there now. And so what's the next epidemic going to be like if that reservoir is out? If now so many people are reservoirs and they're people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if they were just bats and monkeys and whatever, then that might be less likely to be
Another thing you need to
transmit it to humans.
To think about with Ebola, though, is it's been pretty clear that you're only very contagious when you're in very close proximity of someone who's very, very sick. So it's not like it can just creep up from this reservoir right. and get a lot of people all of a sudden.
Right.
That when before someone who is a host of it mm-hmm. that's hiding is non-symptomatic.
But isn't it more likely that that would happen now than it was in the past?
I guess you could argue that.
Sure.
It's more likely.
We're all effed.
So, I mean, I guess I don't know enough about the research that's come out, or I guess the cases, it's not even probably qualified. But, so people have actually gotten Ebola from, like...
toilet seats.
Just, like, they've gotten pregnant from toilet
seats. Was that not it? I'm sorry.
from, you know, like, contact with semen or contact with eye secretions or something.
Yeah, I don't know if it's actually been cases or they've just isolated from those areas.
Because, you know, that's different, too. Like, you can have...
And, in fact, I'm not even sure like it came out through tears or anything like that. It's present in the eyeball. Okay. They can find
it. That's a good point.
Yeah, you can have shedding of, you know, virus without, you know, any having enough to, induce a disease or even live virus, you know.
HIV, they need a number of viral particles to actually transmit the disease. Because your body can take care of a little bit of viruses.
Yeah. Well, these are all questions.
Yeah, it is interesting that it can be found in those, though. But I think it's still very prolific.
Perhaps I'm contributing to the fear.
I think there's just fear-mongering about Ebola,
there's
Dave.
Worse things to be afraid of than Ebola.
Stigmatization. Yeah. I look forward to my
This is a good place for fear-mongering, Dave. Medical school.
The thing, Dave, is you're just like a year behind on the Ebola fear-mongering.
Is he a year ahead?
Maybe he's a year ahead.
Watch Dave be like completely spot on with all of this. They dig up his podcast, world famous.
Mm-hmm. You become like a consultant for the
We don't know what it is about him, but he just thinks like a virus.
He's like an Ebola Nostradamus. He knows exactly.
We're gonna get Dennis Hoffman
because
to
Nostradamus
play you
is so right.
in the made for TV version of this.
Yes. I'm excited.
Yes, thank you, Corey.
I hadn't really taken it to its logical conclusion where I become amazingly famous and the virus itself. Thank you.
Yeah, you become famous.
That's actually the more logical.
Called Dave Bola.
Dave Bola. Blood splatter.
Dave Bola too.
This summer.
This time it's personal.
Last night, I did not sleep.
In a world.
At all? No, and it wasn't because I was thinking of Ebola. It was for no particular reason at all. I just couldn't go to sleep. Eventually I fell asleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. Had to wake up at 6 to come to work, which really sucked. I'm sure...
Such is life.
I woke up at 4 today.
I was going to say, I'm sure you guys... this happens to you all the time, but I am not a medical student, and I... deserve my sleep, damn it.
That's
very true.
We don't deserve it.
That's right. You guys are young. You have healthy bodies. I'm old.
You know, yeah, older people love to say, like, you're young. You don't feel tired, ever. Right?
You're superhuman.
People play that line on me all the time, and I'm like, well...
I don't know if it works that way.
only when I'm using meth.
I don't know if it's coincidence or not, but... Or just ironic, but... yesterday, before I had trouble falling asleep, I read about... a couple of articles about sleep and how, you know, so right now we're blaming modern life, you know, gadgets and electric lights and all that kind of stuff for what we think is this huge sleep deficit that, you know, we have in America and I guess modern society. And, you know, there's an Oxford neuroscientist, Russell Foster, who has said that a lack of sleep contributes directly or indirectly to as much as 30% of medical problems, which I don't know about that.
Seems hard to quantify.
Yeah. Directly or indirectly. So that's, you know, he's pretty much covered the waterfront there. I'm not really sure.
I wouldn't doubt it, but I don't know how he can conclusively say it. Because the thing is, we don't understand a ton about sleep.
Even I was skeptical about that, and I'm willing to believe in, like, mega structures.
Yeah.
But, not, you know, so this new study, though, says that Americans get the same amount of sleep as these three hunter-gatherer societies in Africa and South America that they looked at. You know, they strapped them with, you know, wristwatches and to monitor, wristwatch type devices to monitor.
Don't let us disturb your native lifestyle.
Maybe it's the strapping of the watches that made them sleep less.
But they're described as healthy and fit, even though they get near the low end of sleep times as compared to industrialized countries. They don't go to sleep when the sun goes down, like we sort of imagined that people did before there were electric lights and such. Chronic insomnia affects 20 to 30% of Americans, but only 2% of these hunter-gatherers had insomnia, and two of the tribes don't even seem to have a word for it. And they live to be 60 or 80 years old, so it's not really, you know, there's nothing wrong with them as far as we can tell. So I just think that's kind of interesting.
The whole idea of sleeping for 7 hours and like going to bed like, you know, when the sun goes down is like completely a modern thing.
Yeah.
Like in medieval Europe, it used to be like they would go to bed at like 1 and then they would like wake up they did all sorts of weird stuff.
Yeah, they get up
stuff.
In the yeah. This was the second article I read. They get up in the middle of the night and they go visit each other and they have, you know, sex and they eat.
They have like a little party in the middle of the night and then they go back to sleep.
That's why there's matins, right? That's why monks would get up at like 1 in the morning and pray. And have like little chants and stuff to
offset all the debauchery that's happening.
Yeah, that's the hour of most need.
Dave, do you know how they woke up? Would they like? Because I wonder how much of it is they're waking up naturally versus how we wake up is we force and pry ourselves out of bed, even though every bit of our body is begging us not to, because we're like in the middle of a REM cycle or something, because we're doing it based on time rather than how our body's naturally cycling. Like, I wonder if we wouldn't have these problems with insomnia if we all like allowed ourselves to wake up when our body woke up naturally and then just got up for the day from there.
There's a really cool article about this that was circulating, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. Basically, the guy said, you want to see the way people used to sleep? Here's what you do. When the lights go off, no more light. So when it's dark, you're done for the day. You go to bed. What will happen in 2 weeks is you will begin to wake up in the middle of the night. You will naturally wake up at, I don't know, 2 a.m. and you will want to stay awake for an hour or two and then you'll get tired again.
Yeah.
And if you don't have artificial light, this is what will invariably happen to you.
Yeah, there's at least one study I read of where they sort of replicated that situation where, you know, they kept people in darkness for 14 hours out of the day and they just sort of naturally fell into that rhythm of what they call historically is called first sleep and second sleep. Yeah. So if you go back and look at court documents and marriage records just written stuff from the old days, and basically that's, by that I mean in the 17th up until the 17th century, you can see lots of references to first sleep and second sleep and all that kind of stuff. Things that you know once. I guess it's somehow linked to the Reformation, is what I read, but I don't remember exactly how.
Another thing is that our sleep cycle is like 23 hours, not 24. That's why it's called circadian, because circa means like around a day, so it's not quite a day. So if you put someone in a cave, and like they'll kind of like their schedule will slowly shift because they don't have any outside cues, and they've done those types of experiments too.
They should study the Taliban. Don't they all live in caves?
Can we find them to study them?
That statement is a direct result of only 4 hours.
That's the perfect way to catch the Taliban.
David's going
to
be a prophet and on a watch list from this podcast.
So if you want to do a sleep study, and they're like, oh yeah, sure.
Pay $15 an hour cash.
I don't know.
You heard it here first.
That's right. John, earlier this week you came into my into our domain here and you looked sort of pleased and unsettled and
pleased and unsettled.
Yeah, I mean it was kind of, and he was like pacing around back. What happened to you, man?
So I was in clinic, and I was in head and neck cancer clinic, and I had seen a patient. It was an older gentleman who'd had a total laryngectomy, which is where they take out the whole larynx. And then they basically disconnect the airway, so you now have a stoma in the front, and then they'll do some sort of procedure, or they'll close your pharynx so you can swallow food. And he was getting very frustrated by the fact that really sort of this was the best thing they could offer him. And again, so, you know, my goal there was to just sort of empathize with him. And I did. And I think we had a pretty good communication. I don't think, you know, he wasn't angry at me, but he was really frustrated with the situation. And at one point he stopped and he looked at my badge and he saw that I had hair. And he asked me, you know, John, what happened? And I told him.
Because for new listeners, John is now.
Yes, I'm totally
relatively
bald.
Devoid of Squeaky. Hair.
He asked me, you know, what happened, and I told him about alopecia. Just kind of explained it's a white blood cell defect that causes your white blood cells to attack your hair. And he asked me, you know, is that some sort of cancer? And I said, no. You know, it pretty much just caused me to lose my hair, and that's not really a big deal. But there are some other risks associated with it. And one of them, which I'm deathly afraid of, is called Sjogren's syndrome, where your immune cells, your white blood cells, have a tendency to attack your glands. And so you lose the ability to salivate and to produce tears. And so eventually you just go blind because your eyes get too dry. And we don't really have very good treatment for it because not a whole lot of people have it. So there's not, like, you know, billions of dollars of research going into it. And anyway, I told him that, and he looked at me and he said, you know, we should really pray to get through that. That's how I got through my cancer. And I sat and I thought about it for a few seconds, and I looked at him and I told him, you know, you are a testament to me of just the kinds of things that we could go through, the unbelievable kinds of things that we could go through, and still come out on the other end really loving our life. Because I could tell, you know, he was really frustrated, but I could tell he really loved his life. And that was the moment where it kind of broke, where time and space kind of broke for me. And I was looking in his eyes, he was looking in mine, and I know that we both knew sort of what that meant, you know, to really meet a human being on that level. And I had this sort of profound feeling kind of wash over me, and it sort of possessed me. And so I when I came back here and I was talking to Dave about it, I mean, I was like starting to get worried that I was having some kind of manic episode or something like that. Like I was like becoming delusional or something. But I think what happened was that I was just, you know, I just had that kind of moment where you're really in the zone and you really, you know, you're really doing the thing that's right for you, you know, and it mm-hmm. was that profound realization that I'm doing exactly the right thing, and that to be there at that moment and to have that opportunity with that patient was exactly the right thing.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that other than you're pretty lucky to have had that moment, because I don't know if everybody gets through what you guys are doing.
No, I can't. I wouldn't say I've had a moment that profound yet. I'd like to hope that being this being the career that I'm choosing. I mean, that's why I think a lot of us get into it, right? And I think that's part of the connection you made.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think this is, it's, I don't know that it's something, you know, in the sense that I'm chasing after. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I would definitely rank it as one of the most profound moments of my life. You know, there was this sort of perfect storm of, you know, in the psychology literature, they call it flow. Mm-hmm. And you ask, you know, professional athletes, they say I was in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of that, the combination of a real sense of purpose, you know, and I'm not a religious man, but my God, I could tell you right there, you know, that's.
You were feeling something.
That's
something like
there. In that sense, there's something out there, you know. And
you were having a secular gospel explosion somewhere within your body.
Exactly.
That is quite the image. Thing.
Now throw some Ebola in there.
I had my gospel gland filleth and runneth over.
Okay, this is getting a little.
It's fine. I think it's really exciting. I think to have that kind of opportunity and to be in this kind of place, because I think, you know, if this is the kind of thing that you think you might want to do, you know, we look to a lot of sort of rituals to find moments like that. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, medicine's not a bad place to do that. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, that's sort of the implicit assumption that sort of like profound fulfillment is something that we could all find, and would be insane to believe it's something we could find at work.
Yeah.
I just think it's interesting, you know, when you talk about like transcendental experiences, there's such a broad range of things that cause these type of moments, you know, like, mm-hmm. like there's a famous, was it Baudelaire? I think he had like ate a cookie, and it like he had like this profound flashback to his childhood. Like if there's like a really good TED talk called "My Stroke of Insight," where it had a mm-hmm. stroke and had like this really
oh sure
you know, and it's just yeah. interesting how there's such a, like a different, you know, like I'm sure for like some people in the Zen tradition, they could be like hit by this experience while they're washing dishes, you know. It's just very interesting how there's such a depending on the individual, just such a like a broad range of what types of experiences elicit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just almost like the antidote to the preclinical curriculum.
Gets it fired up.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I think it's really easy for me to be enthusiastic about getting up at 4 a.m. every day now and just doing what I need, because that didn't come out of some sort of like special thing I did.
Yeah.
It wasn't because I like did some sort of anything different. I mean, what I did was I just worked hard. I applied myself. I thought, you know, I'm just going to do the best that I can in clinic today. And I wasn't even thinking about the consequences of that. I just said, well, let's do it. You know, I'll go see this next patient. And then
maybe chance favors the prepared mind, right?
Maybe fortune does favor the prepared.
I'm pretty deep.
You know, as we talk about this, it's kind of striking to me. Given where I am in my medical training, which is halfway through my first semester of my second year, which has been, it's been tough. You know, I think, you know, you guys have all done it. And it's super isolating because you have to spend hours by yourself studying. And that's just the way it is. And everyone feels it. But it's just interesting how there can be such a spectrum of, like, you had this great moment of this connection that a lot of people don't get in life, you know? And that's something that's truly special about the medical field, and I think, or that is truly why we're privileged to do what we do, you know? Like, very rarely do you get to connect with a stranger on a very human level, you know?
Did you tell this story to a bunch of M2s? Because they all got their schedules today. I have never seen a bunch of M2s get so excited to get their... so this is the...
Well, it's because the curriculum timing is different. They're getting their schedules when everything looks bleakest. When they're buckling down for a hard semester in step one.
So for those of you at home... at home. For those of you at the gym or in class... There is this is the point at which the second year students got their clerkship schedule, so that they know pretty much when and where they will be going to their clinical experiences in the next. Mm-hmm. You know, so that starts in a couple of months.
Yes.
And they got those schedules today. And seriously, they were like, they were out in the hall. There was a huge group out in the hallway. They were all like, you know, running around like,
Dave, can I tell you a story about this?
Yes. No.
It's a little tangential,
no,
but
moving on.
the payoff is valuable.
All right.
There was a boss in a plant, and he had a lot of women that worked for him. He was a clothing plant.
Mm-hmm.
And what he would do is he liked
American
a certain
apparel.
Yeah. And he liked a certain kind of music that none of the people that worked for him liked. And so he would play it really loud, mm-hmm. like way too loud. And then, you know, they'd come and they'd complain, you know, and he'd just turn it up. You know, and then they would be like just about to strike. They were organized. They'd show up in a group. They were really pissed off. You know, they were just losing it. And then he'd turn it down. and they would have a celebration and they'd go back to work energized, and he would just stand there going, they thought they had control. They thought they had control.
Hear that, med students? You're all puppets.
Wow. Well, on that note,
the administration giveth and they taketh away.
I always like to end the show on a high note. So, we'll do this. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. What did you think of today's show? Tell us at theshortcode.com, on Twitter, on Facebook. Several ways to get in touch with us, but if you leave us a voicemail, I can play on the air by calling 347-SHORT-CT. Well, what could be better? The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine student government and the Writing and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.